Chapter 10. It still amuses Ventanus that a mark he made in haste upon a wax paper map has become so synonymous with the defenders of Kalth. With Lancia laid waste by the orbital batteries, the defenders had needed a place to rally. With virtually every data engine on the planet dead, a picked scan was made of Ventanus's map with a rally point marked with black ash. That scan was broadcast through every civilian picked caster and legion slate within reach of Lancia, and thus was named this bastion of resistance. Arcology X. Two quick crosswise slashes on a map, and an element of geography became a piece of history, a symbol of resistance and a talisman to brandish in the face of the enemy. Chapter 11. The caverns are dim. Power consumption is carefully controlled. The few Mechanicum adepts have yet to stabilize a link to the geothermal grid at the heart of Kalth. Flickering lumen globes in protective caging are strung from brickwork supports on looping cables like jungle creepers. This close to the surface, the architecture has a martial character, but with every sub-level they traverse, the more civic and functional it becomes. The walls are etched with meters-high X's, and hundreds more on every archway and lintel. Among them, Ventanus sees pictures drawn on the walls, serpentine creatures with dark wings and fanged mouths. Draconis. He sees a childishness to the scratched lines and wonders if these nightmares have been drawn on the walls as a means of expelling them. Are they memories of the monsters brought forth by the heinous pacts made by the word-bearers, or visions drawn from the nightmares common in the wake of the attack? News of Ventanus's mission has already reached Arcology X, and the return of the Fourth is greeted with cheers and loud huzzas from the thousands of civilians packed into its sprawling sublevels. Someone shouts the word Savior, and the cry is taken up by the multitudes packed into the caves. It follows them down the levels as they plunge deeper and deeper into the bedrock of Kalth. Psydance is waiting for them at the gateway to the administration levels. His cobalt-blue armor is clean and polished. Some of the Legion have made oaths not to remove the dust and blood of war until Kalth is reclaimed. But like Ventanus, Lyros Psydance wants the word-bearers to see the Ultramarines are still the regal battle kings of Macragge. No amount of treachery and no grief will ever change that. But even Psydance has adopted the black X on his shoulder guard, carefully etched between the curved arms of the marbled Ultima. It looks like a chapter number or a company designation, but it is something far more important.
"You're making a name for yourself down here, Remus," says Psydance as the chants continue behind them.
"Nothing to do with me, Lyros," replies Ventanus. "This has your fingerprints all over it."
Psydance shrugs and grips Ventanus's wrist.
"A bit of hope and glory never hurt anyone."
Ventanus does not release Psydance's arm.
"I want it to stop."
"Why? What you're doing, it's giving people hope."
"I'm not a savior," says Ventanus, "and I don't like the connotations of the word."
"You don't have to like it, you just have to endure it," says Psydance,
turning and making his way down the ramp into the cavern.
"Come on, the server's waiting for you at the Ultimus."
The war for Kalth is being coordinated from the lowest level of Arcology X, a cavern seared from the lithosphere by melter drills and seismic charges. Beneath the levels of habitation, engineering and hydroponics, it is a rock-clad dome some 3 kilometres in diameter, with numerous branching passageways, sub-galleries and twisting dead ends radiating from its central void. At its heart stands a structure of polished marble and glass, utilitarian in elevation, but designed in the shape of the 13th Legion sigil. Armoured panels encase its lower levels, and tech marines aboard Tecton pattern rhinos work side by side with Mechanicum servitors to transform it into something resembling a strong point. Before the invasion, the building was owned by a trading cartel founded in the time of Gilliman's adoptive father. It is named Conor's Arch, but it is now known as the Ultimus. Its robust infrastructure and powerful data engines, designed to link subsidiary operations across the 500 worlds, make it the perfect base from which to conduct offensive operations against the remaining word-bearers. Such concerns are vital, but once again, The symbolism of the structure is paramount. Hundreds of temporary structures surround the Ultimus, overspill from the levels above. So great were the numbers of refugees fleeing Landshear that the upper levels quickly filled, and Ventanus had no option but to allow billets to be set up around his command post. He doesn't like it, but has little choice in the matter. There is simply nowhere else for them to go. Word of their coming has reached the refugees, and people cluster at the edge of the clearway that leads to the gates of the Ultimus. People cheer, and wave, and clap. They shout his name, and once again call him Saviour. He keeps his expression neutral, but catches sight of Sidance's amusement.
"You might not like the connotation, but the Saviour of Kalth has a nice ring to it," says Sidance. "It's a title that'll stick, mark my words."
"So what do they call you?"
"I haven't decided yet," says Sidance with a grin. "But we'll all have titles by the end of this."
Ventanus walks on. He knows Sidance is right, but it still irks him to have the mantle of Saviour thrust upon him. He dislikes the self-aggrandizement and its faintly theological undertones, but is canny enough to know that nothing he can do now will stop its spread.
"So, are you going to say it?"
asks Sidance.
"Say what? That you were right after all, and that I was wrong?"
"I don't need to," says Ventanus. "The truth is self-evident. 600 word-bearers dead without the loss of a single warrior."
"Yes, very impressive,"
agrees Sidance, placing two fingers to his forehead and narrowing his eyes as though in a trance.
"I see many laurels in your future, great statues built in your likeness, and a name that echoes through eternity."
Ventanus allows a thin smile to surface.
"I will shoot you if you use those psychic powers again."
Sidance laughs and turns from Ventanus and addresses the two sergeants behind him.
"Barker, Sellerton, good job."
The sergeants acknowledge his words, but do not reply. Ventanus looks up and sees Serva Torin and her newly acquired retinue of Lex Mechanics, Calculus Logi, and Data Savants approaching. He is still learning the nuances of human interactions, something forced upon him by increased contact with the populace of Kalth in recent weeks, but has become familiar with the hybrid machine-flesh expressions of the Mechanicum. Torin has the chimeric qualities common to the members of the Martian priesthood: detachment, aloofness, and a disconnect that some see as cold. But right now, Ventana sees nothing of detachment, nothing of disconnect. What he sees in Torin's face is an abyss of all too human despair.
"Something has happened," he says.
"What is it?"
"CV-427 Praxor is gone," says Torin. "Two others as well."
"Gone?" he says. "What does that mean?"
"It means that they are radioactive craters hundreds of kilometers wide," says Torin.
Chapter 12. Theoretical: deny the word-bearers the chance to regroup. Practical: achieve the same for the defenders of Kalth. Result: bring the Ultramarines back into the fight against the Warmaster. These are the prime directives by which the 13th are operating, but knowing them and achieving them are two very different things. Gathered around the central plotting table in a gleaming conference chamber that now serves as Kalth's command centre are the men and women Ventanus needs to turn that theoretical into a workable practical. Sidance and Urath stand shoulder to shoulder, his fellow 4th Company captain half a head taller than the sergeant of the 39th. Though his rank is inferior to that of Sidance, the hard-faced Urath has given fresh purpose to the scattered survivors of Sullis's company. Ventanus will see to it that he receives a captaincy for that. Serva Torin consults with her Martian acolytes. He cannot see it, but knows there will be a haze of noospheric information buzzing around their heads in veils of data light. She sifts invisible information with her hands. Behind her, a brutish Skitarii clan chief stands, hulking and primitive-looking. He has nothing of the calm poise of Ceramica, and is clearly a much lower-ranking battle leader. His limbs are sheathed in metal, and the lower half of his skull is a tusked metallic trap, like a greenskin's jaw. Colonel Hamadri, consults a data slate, her face set in an expression of cold determination. She has a son in the Numina 61st, but has no knowledge of whether he is alive or dead. Statistical probability favours the latter, but until such time as his death can be confirmed, her madre will believe him alive. This is good. Ventanus needs people around him who can hope against the odds. Across from her madre is Captain Volpa Ulliet of the 77th Ingenium Support Division, a heavily built career officer who in 50 years of service has never left Kalth or seen combat before the last few weeks. At first glance, he's an unlikely choice for the command table, but Ventana sees beyond his service record to his actions during the initial phase of the attack. Where the shock of the Wordbearer's attack left others stupefied, Ulliet reacted in moments. Within 4 minutes of the attack's commencement, his battalions of construction engines and earth-moving machines were raising redoubts and defensive bulwarks around the main gates of Lancia's central arcology. This, too, is good. Ventanus needs people who can react with speed. Ingenium Subiaco stands close to Torin, and his pleasure at being in the presence of a Mechanicum adept is obvious. Subiaco has only the most superficial augmetics, none that cannot be easily removed, and he hero-worships those who commune so directly with a machine god. Ancreon tells Ventanus that Subiaco is doing good work in the tunnels, securing the multitude of potential entry points to Arcology X. The man is exhausted, but refuses to take his rest. All the mortals are tertiary forces, reservists, or commands designated to be rear echelon units. Most are filled with raw recruits, soldiers raised specifically for the campaign against the Gazlak Xenohold, a campaign Ventanus now understands to be entirely fictive. The forces still at Lancia Port when the sun died were the last to be embarked, fresh regiments, engineering units, or logistical support elements. Almost none are frontline certified. Sidance tells Ventanus repeatedly that they're not ready for what he asks of them, and the stark light of the chamber only seems to confirm this. Every face is pinched and knurled with loss and shock. Sidance is right. They're not ready, but Ventanus believes that treachery has honed their previously unfinished edge. Complacency has been purged from their bones by the devastation above. None beyond the Legion warriors were known to Ventanus before he made Arcology X's base of operations, but he knows them all now. He has made it his business to learn their strengths, their weaknesses, and all the human foibles he must factor into his plans. Some think he wastes his time in attempting to understand mortals, but Ventanus knows better. The only way space marines can now function alongside mortals is to understand them.
Server, says Ventanus, apprise me.
Torin nods, and subcutaneous light shimmers through her fingers as she manipulates the plotting table with quick haptic gestures. A static-washed holographic of a giant smoke-filled crater appears on the table, 100 kilometres across. It blights the landscape, and always will. Pixelated vapour clouds the size of cities are tugged by rogue thermals and atomic vortices. You have all heard the news from CV-427 Praxor, she says. And the others, says Colonel Hamadri, her thin face blotchy with untreated Radburn. We lost more than 2 million people last night. Heads nod. The scale of death too terrible to contemplate. Such a vast number is difficult to visualize, too enormous for proper comprehension. Hamadri is a defense auxiliar colonel, young to hold such rank. Ventanus sees she has heart, and that will count for a great deal in the coming years. Hamadri kept her units on the surface as long as possible to allow the greatest number of refugees access to the arcology.
Do we know what happened? Asks Sidance.
CV-427 Praxor was an armament stockpile for the orbital platforms and Legion warships, says Torin. Given the electromagnetic signatures and recorded yields from the 3 blast sites, it seems likely that enemy infiltrators were able to modify and detonate a number of warheads from the cyclonic torpedoes stored there.
How is that possible? Demands Hamadri. Those weapons are under Mechanicum protection. Don't you people have security systems in place to stop that kind of thing? It's your fault they're dead.
Torin is visibly distressed by Hamadri's accusation, and her knuckles whiten as she grips the edge of the plotted table. Holographic clouds bend towards her in response.
That's enough, Colonel, says Ventanus.
His tone leaves no room to argue, but Torin raises a hand. She does not need him to defend her, and answers Hamadri with remarkable calm.
Yes, we have ritual protocols to prevent such breaches, but the systemic corruption introduced to the planetary new sphere compromised a great many of our liturgical security systems.
I thought your kill code got rid of it, says Hamadri.
Torin nods.
The kill code of Magos Hest burned the enemy scrap code in a firestorm of numerical carnage, yes, but one that was indiscriminate in its purging. Many of our own systems were left crippled in the wake of the restoration of command authority. Those systems are even now being restored.
So could this happen again? Asks Elliot.
I have personally inspected the security protocols at all other such weapon caches, says Torin.
That's not what I asked, says Elliot.
Yes, it is, replies Torin, and her certainty is palpable.
Elliot nods, the matter settled.
So how do we answer this atrocity? Sidance asks. We'll hit the bastards hard for this.
They respond to Sidance's words, and Ventana sees the desire for vengeance in every face. He remembers his fellow captain espousing the same retributive mantra upon his arrival at Leptius Numinus. It is a primal and eminently understandable urge to strike back at those who have wronged them. But it is as ill-advised now as it was then. Ventanus leans forward and places both hands on the edge of the table.
We answer by staying alive to finish the fight, he says. We continue coordinating what forces remain combat effective and devise a practical from that. The dead of Praxor are gone, and nothing will bring them back. Grieve when Kalth is free, but while you are in this room, you all belong to me. Understand and accept that, or get out.
Stony silence greets his words. They hate his cold objectivity, his apparent lack of concern for the dead. Ventanus cares nothing for their approval, but he has to give them something, some spark to light the fire in their hearts. He is not good with such words, and these are the best he can do.
The word-bearers will pay for this, but this war will not be won with impulse, it will be won with cool heads and solid practical. We fight for the living, and we kill for the dead. Say it with me.
The silence stretches.
Say it with me,
he says again.
Heads nod, fists are made over hearts.
We fight for the living, and we kill for the dead.
Chapter 13. Radioactive winds howl across Leprium, sounding hot and crackling in his helmet. The counter reads high, but his warplate can withstand this intensity for days before its systems will need to recharge. Malloc Cartho looks up into a sky laced with the poison borealis and heartsick rainbows of stellar fallout. The cascade of exotic particles and heavy metals will leave Kalth a polluted wasteland from now until its star finally burns out and engulfs the entire Viridian system. For all Cartho knows, that could be in millions of years, or it could be tomorrow. He cares not either way. He will never return to Kalth. It is reckless to stand so brazenly on the surface, but the powers to whom he owes fealty demand no less. Devastation surrounds him, the sprawling ruin of a dead city. Twisted steel, shattered permacrete, and broken glass. Upturned tanks and supply containers that fell from the ruptured bellies of bulk tenders straining for orbit are scattered everywhere. Amidst the destruction, a statue, fashioned from bronze, but now heavy with grey ash, stands at the end of a grand processional. It is a heroic representation of the mortal who raised Gilliman as his own. Conor, the first battle king of Macragge. Bodies lie in drifts around the statue, as though the doomed populace of Leprium believed his legacy might somehow protect them from the slaughter. Cartho pities them their ignorance of the galaxy's true divine masters. A wrecked Imperator Titan stands sentinel over the ruins, hot, neutron-rich vortices gusting between its legs and sagging carapace. Its chest battlements are blown out, and half its head section is missing. Grey dust falls in drifts from its listing carapace, but it is impossible to tell whether its loyalty was to Horus or the Emperor.
One of ours or one of theirs?
Asks Hol Beloth, emerging from the shelter of a tumble-down ruin of flooring plates and corrugated roof slabs. The commander has embraced his duty of atrocity with all the zeal one would expect of one of Lorgar's sons. The murder of the civilian shelters has galvanized him, and the touch of the Bloody One fills his body with power. That he thinks such banal deaths will be enough to save him makes Carthos' lip curl in a mixture of amusement and contempt.
"Who knows?" says Carthos. "At this point, it hardly matters." "Could it be salvaged? Turned against the 13th?
Carthos shakes his head in disbelief. Hol Beloth mistakes this for his answer.
"I suppose it is too badly damaged," says Hol Beloth.
That the fool believes there is still a war to be won on Calf is laughable. The Wordbearer's victory has already been achieved, and the fate of this rock is irrelevant. Yes, the Ultramarines were not as humbled as Cor Faeron desired, but they are broken as a fighting force, spent. They will waste their efforts to reclaim a world that has no value. Lorgar has likely already forgotten Calf. The powers beyond the Great Eye have their gaze turned upon the Golden One, and the burning of Ultramar is just the beginning of his grand schemes. Malok Carthos has ambitions of his own, and what he does here is simply the next step on his path to glory. He already feels his unnamed shadow moving through the darkness, an ink-black leviathan that swallows worlds and exterminates species for its fleeting amusement. He senses it hunting fresh prey even now, mortal beings who have somehow managed to escape Calf by means that should be impossible. His hand slips over the glass surface of his warp flask as he senses its squirming reptilian hunger. Whoever it hunts must be special indeed to have elicited such pleasure in one so vast as to be beyond human understanding.
"We shouldn't be out here," says Hol Beloth, breaking into Carthos' thoughts.
The commander looks up into the wide sky. He feels too exposed to enjoy its technicolor death throes.
"You saw what happened to Lanshear." "I did," agreed Cartho, "and it was wondrous. But still, we wait."
"You'll see us all killed," says Hol Beloth, lapsing into uneasy silence.
Hol Beloth feels acutely vulnerable here without his army, but to bring such numbers to the surface would bring the wrath of the Ultramarines' orbital guns down upon them within moments. Besides, thinks Cartho, the Brotherhoods will soon serve a much grander purpose where they are. Cartho cast his augurs wide in choosing the legionaries who would accompany them. To achieve his goal, only the deadliest warriors could hope to survive, only the most devoted and ruthless. There are few as single-minded in their adoration as Eriesh Kigal. Encased in a war-scarred suit of Terminator armor, Kigal stands head and shoulders above Cartho, his arched pauldrons and slab-like breastplate dancing with static and irradiated dust. Each fist is a lightning claw, and his demon-visaged helm now bears two curling horns. Six similarly clad warriors stand with Kigal, armed with a mix of combi bolters, lightning claws, chain fists, and energized warhammers. They bear the mark of the Octid upon their shoulders, and Cartho has inscribed each veteran's scarred faceplate with his own personal sigil. Towering over them all is a silent dreadnought with a casket plate bearing the etched name of Zu Ganara. Cartho knows nothing of that warrior. Whatever flesh scraps once sloshed in amniotic grease within have now been devoured by a void-hard darkness with teeth and eyes. The hulking war machine is no longer simply a dreadnought, but a thing of the night with iron fists.
"So, what are we waiting for?"
asks Hol Beloth, pacing back and forth in the shadow of a soot-blackened metal pressing plant.
"For the bringers of a mighty gift," says Cartho, seeing a dust cloud threading its way through the ruins.
The coughing splutter of a labouring engine echoes dully across the ashen remnants of the broken city. Hol Beloth hears it too, and his hand goes to the crowned hilt of his sword.
"Ultramarines?"
he asks.
"No."
"How can you be sure?"
"Because we are still alive," says Cartho, as a wide-bodied industrial vehicle with a transport compartment at the rear comes into view.
It ploughs through the knee-high dust between the gutted buildings, riding low on its suspension, heavy with potential. The remains of a spread eagled skeleton are lashed to the roof of the vehicle. Only the pitted, corroded plates of carapace armour and shreds of uniform hold the body together. No flesh remains on the skeleton. The bones bleach the pallor of ash.
Major Cadine, I presume, says Cartho with a throaty chuckle.
Holbeloth looks strangely at him, but he doesn't satisfy his curiosity. Though he has dismissed Holbeloth's concerns, Cartho looks up for any sign of their having been discovered. He has chosen his moment carefully. The clashing electromagnetic storm should render any geosats overhead blind to this portion of the city.
Come, says Cartho,
and he and Holbeloth step from the shelter of the covering structure. Kigal's Terminators and Zugunara follow them through the detritus of the flattened metropolis. Structures designed to withstand earthquake, fire and flood have been brought low by war, and the sight pleases Cartho greatly. The vehicle wheezes towards them, finally stopping in the shadow of Konor's statue. Its blue paintwork has flaked off, as though burned away from the inside. The bare metal of its frame and panels is already corroding. The Terminators lock the double barrels of their guns on the driver's window. Cartho hears the buzz of target acquisition lasers and ranging motors over the city's groaning lament of steel and the dusty susurration of the wind. The vehicle's crew doors open, and Cartho smells the rich aroma of decaying meat. A man bearing the mark of the Brotherhood lurches from the cab's interior, and Cartho sees death upon him. He wears it proudly, a mass of rotten tissue that weeps milky fluid from the rampant sores covering every visible centimetre of his skin. His eyes are yellow, veined with ruptured capillaries, and virtually blind with cataracts. Holbeloth draws his sword, and he sees the man wears the uniform of the enemy. He has not yet realised that this man is one of their own. Another Brotherhood acolyte emerges from the opposite door, and his afflictions are even worse. Blood leaks from every pore, and windborne dust abrades the flesh from his bones with every gust. Cartho sees a third man through the warped glass of the canopy. His skin has peeled from his skull, and he stares sightlessly at the Dark Apostle through fluid-filled sockets. His hands are fused with the steering column in some strange biological symbiosis. Blind and enduring unspeakable torment, he has been guided here by the dark monarchs of the warp. Holbeloth reaches into the vehicle and rips the driver's insignia from his uniform. A flap of wet meat comes with it and flops to the dust. He looks at the insignia, and it takes him a second to make the connection. Cartho steps around the vehicle to where the dying men are pulling back a heavy tarpaulin. Holbeloth appears at his side as the weapon they have come for is revealed. It is spherical in shape and smaller than Cartho had expected, a metre long, including the protective metal case. Its surfaces are smooth, the blue paint gone, leaving its body a dull grey that matches the former colour of the word-bearers. An unambiguous warning symbol is acid-etched onto its side. A circular ring, with three splayed arms radiating from its centre to form three circles in a pyramid form. Since the earliest days, this has been the sigil of an elemental power, an unknowing rendition of the fear of pestilence carried in the hearts and minds of mortals since the dawn of time. Holbeloth holds up the driver's insignia.
These men came from the Praxor shelter before it was destroyed.
That they did, agrees Cartho.
The shadow of Zugunara falls over them as the dreadnought lifts the warhead from the transport compartment. It is heavy, and the vehicle visibly lifts from the dust. The men, whose flesh is slipping from their frames like wet cloth, sigh in pleasure.
Is this what I think it is? Asks Holbeloth.
Cartho nods. He feels the warp flask at his hip squirm with agitation. With the acquisition of this weapon of total destruction, his union with the immaterial creature grows ever closer. Cartho feels its resistance. It wants to finish its hunt, but the fates have decreed their joining, and nothing will prevent it.
We cannot fight the Ultramarines conventionally, says Cartho. We are new-born Catacan devils in a bottle, each capable of killing the other, but only at the risk of his own life.
The Terminators level their guns at the Brotherhood warriors.
That is not how we will fight, continues Cartho.
The dying men drop to their knees and spread their arms in gratitude. Bare bone gleams. Ribs shine wetly through sloughing flesh. A bark of gunfire tears their dissolving bodies apart in an explosion of rotten matter. Flaming lumps of meat spatter the buildings nearby. Eriesh Kigal, affixes melter charges to the vehicle. There must be no trace of it left for the geosats to discover. The intense heat will vaporize the transport and kill off any traces of biological taint. The Ultramarines must have no warning of the new threat that has emerged from the weapon stores of CV-427 Praxor.
How do you intend to use it? Asks Hol Beloth.
How do you think? Says Malok Kartho. I am going to use it to kill Kalth.
Chapter 14. A haze of light lies over the plotting table's surface like a low-lying fog. Drifting particulates are caught in the diffuse light of the hollows, causing flickering refraction errors in the topography displayed. It is Kalth's surface rendered in greens, browns, and yellow. Icons representing Ultramarines' positions and their allies are marked in gold and blue. Known word-bearers and cultist positions in hostile red. Two consistent red icons are of greatest concern to Ventanus. One in the heart of the foundries north of Lanshear, the other within the Uranic radial.
How often do the geosats initiate a surface auger?
Asks Sidance as Torin zooms in on each icon, friendly and hostile. Time stamps appear above each one. The most recent is 6 hours old. Access to orbital auguries is still sporadic, she says, shifting the map around with thought impulses through the MIU cabling plugged into the table. Most of the geosats were knocked out in the first moments of the attack. The few that remain are slave to the orbital weapon platforms to alert us to any surface movements of Wordbearer's forces. Ventanus repeats Sidance's question.
How often?
Every 10 hours, says Torin. That's as much inload as the Ultimus Nusphere can accommodate until more powerful data engines can augment its capacity.
That's a long time, says Hamadri.
A long time, snaps Sidance, shaking his head. It's a lifetime. This map is worthless. Remus, we can't devise theoretical, let alone practical, from data that's 10 hours old.
6 hours, says Ventanus.
It could be 6 or 10 minutes and it would be just as bad, says Sidance.
The map is as accurate as circumstances allow, responds Torin as the map zooms out.
You're overlooking one thing, Lyros, says Ventanus.
I am?
What?
There are more gold icons today than there were yesterday, he says. Every day, our forces grow.
The word-bearers can have no such expectation. Server, how many more Loyalist forces have you established contact with since the last update?
13 more underground shelters and sealed cave systems are now confirmed, answers Torin, and the new additions bob like eager children on the map.
2 weeks ago, we were broken and scattered, on the verge of extermination, says Ventanus. Now we have coordination with nearly 40,000 of our Legion brothers, 250,000 army and mechanicum assets, and 16 Legio Titanicus engines. Every day brings us closer to becoming a globally unified force. The word-bearers are alone, cut off from every hope of aid. They are fighting just to stay alive. But we fight for Kalth.
Ventanus spreads his hands to encompass the gold icons on the table. He sees renewed hope. His words promise them a victory, but they think the war will be won in a matter of months. They think the word-bearers will be pushed from Kalth without difficulty. They are wrong, and Ventanus needs to bring some cold reality to the table. Using the manual controls, he highlights the area of the map that shows the two red symbols that trouble him the most. Force disposition icons and unit identifiers flicker to life as he manipulates the controls. The data is old and incomplete, but together with what he has seen with his own eyes, it is enough.
A word-bearer's commander named Fodral Fell is building a fortress in the northern foundry districts, he says. And Hol Beloth, the warlord who raised Lanshear, has regrouped beneath the Uranic radial. Beloth seems to have adopted a hold-fast position, so we can discount him for now. But we can't allow Fell to establish a secure base in the north.
You have a theoretical?
Asks Sidance, eager to be unleashed.
I do, grins Ventanus. We march north and kill the bastard.
Chapter 15. The tunnels around Ingenium Subiaco are gloomy and lit by dancing flames that he cannot see. Each passage bears the hallmarks of being naturally formed, but their dimensions are too perfect, too geometric to be anything other than artificial. The underground structures of Kalf are an Ingenium's idea of paradise, a realm where geology, engineering, and art come together. There are few underground cavern systems he has not visited, mapped, and devised great schemes for linking. An entire underground planetary ecology, self-sustaining and self-perpetuating. His plans are even now being put into action. Designs, philosophies, and practical means of achieving their completion have been transmitted to most of the largest subterranean shelters for implementation. The cavern is a glistening silver colour, suggestive of the eastern arcologies, the walls wet and dripping. Ingenium Subiaco has never feared solitude. He has found peace in the quiet times spent at a drafting slate, buried in a technical librarium, or immersed in the design theory of the great thinkers of previous ages. He enjoys time spent with friends and family, but he acknowledges that he quickly reaches a point where he wishes to be alone. Those closest to him know this about him and recognize the signs of his wandering attention and nascent irritability. They make allowances for him, and Subiaco is grateful for their understanding of what he knows is a flaw in his character. Subiaco relishes solitude and the chance to immerse himself in his work. But this is something else entirely. He is utterly alone. This is not just the absence of people, but the absence of the existence of other people. Ingenium Subiaco understands with total clarity that he is the only man alive on Kalf. He does not know where he is and has no memory of coming here. Each cave mouth is a yawning abyss, a pathway to horror or a gateway to some dreadful terror, locked away in ages past and now free to climb to the surface. Caves and their exploration hold no terror for Subiaco. He has squirmed through the tiniest of cracks and pushed his wiry frame into some of the most inaccessible cave systems this planet has to offer. But these yawning entrances scare him more than anything. He cannot count how many there are. Every time his gaze shifts, the cavern seems to rearrange its walls, and the black-limbed cave mouths constrict without appearing to move. Subiaco feels hot breath exhale from the nearest cave and backs away. Which route leads to the surface? Do any of them? He can see none of the cave markings etched by the earliest explorers, designed to aid the lost in finding their way back to the surface. It is as though this cave has never been trod by Kalf's people. Laughter drifts from somewhere, and he spins around as shadows chase one another over the walls. Drifts of steam sigh from cracks in the floor, but there is no heat to them. In fact, the cavern is like a storage chiller. His breath mists the air, and he sees crackling daggers of ice form on overhanging crags of rock. "This isn't real," he says, finally making the intuitive leap to realize that he's dreaming. But Subiaco is wise enough to see that understanding this and ending it are two very different things. Orange light seeps into the cavern, the glimmer of distant fires. Subiaco remembers a crumbling text born to Kalf from Terra itself and said to be tens of thousands of years old. Its stasis-sealed pages spoke of a place far below the ground where all the devils and evildoers of the world would be sent upon their deaths. This was said to be a place of fire and torment. With the sky above him and the light of the sun on his face, Subiaco scoffed at such ancient superstition. But here in the darkness, his animal core quails in fear. The deep flames are growing hotter, and the walls of the cavern begin to drip, sloughing their substance as though shaped from wax and not solid rock. The entire cavern structure is disintegrating, coming undone with the speed of an unmasked lie. The walls flake and peel away like cinders in a fire, the ceiling falling in a rain of blood-soaked ash. And behind that waxen veneer, a swaying mesh of iron lath and haphazardly constructed supports. It is a madman's structure that cannot possibly support the burden being placed upon it, and beyond that, a howling void of utter emptiness. No, not empty. not empty at all. Unimaginably huge shapes move within the void, leviathans that have outgrown the paltry scale of the word. It horrifies Subiaco that this fragile lattice is all that stands between him and these monsters. He backs away from the nearest chain-link wall as a vast eye blinks before him. Subiaco only knows it is an eye because a pupil, the size of a small moon, dilates as it notices him. The structure around him trembles, and the shockwaves spread to the farthest reaches of the caves. He hears the sound of groaning steelwork and the grinding squeal of metal on metal. Something breaks over to his left, and Subiaco hears the tap, tap, tap of steel claws at the iron lath. Hears it buckling and pulled apart. Cackling laughter bubbles from somewhere that could be 1,000 kilometers away or could be right behind him. Subiaco does not wait to find out, and runs in what he hopes is the opposite direction. He hears the scrape of metal-sheathed bodies pushing their way through tears that are too small for their impossible forms. He hears the shrieks of their pain and the howls of their hunger. He keeps running, knowing better than to look back and see what's chasing him. All he knows is that he has to get away. He runs, and the sound of hundreds of polished steel blades echoes around him. They shed sparks that light the unravelling reality in strobing flashes and throw out elongated shadows of malformed limbs, distended jaws, and gutting fangs. Subiaco screams as he hears thousands more of the amorphous bladed things beyond the lattice pushing their way into the collapsing cave structure. They will kill him if they catch him, but he fears that what will come after will be far worse. Then ahead, a miracle. A great adamantium door, a towering portal that more accurately deserves and utterly owns the title of gate. It alone has resisted the dissolution of the caverns. It alone retains its solidity in the face of the corruption from beyond that unmakes all it touches. The gate is black and glossy, built from cyclopean blocks of titanic stone hewn from the depths of a lightless ocean. It is sealed at its centre by a great golden circle, upon which is wrought a complex alchemical and mathematical equation, the Clockwork Angel. It is an ancient problem, but one that is known to Subiaco. He understands, with a clarity only terror can impart, that its solution will open the gate. An ornate keyboard of brass and jet sits at the centre of the great seal, and his fingers make quick stabs at the black keys. Gears spin, pins unlock, and interleaved discs of gleaming metal separate as the lock disengages and the seal splits down the middle. Golden light spills through the gap between the leaves of the gate as it opens. It is cleansing and purifying, so bright that it threatens to blind him. Subiaco shields his eyes from the radiance, feeling its welcoming heat spread over him. Behind him, he hears the screams of a bladed beast pursuing him. The light is lethal to them. It burns and unweaves the dark power holding their bodies. The golden light spreads, undoing the damage done to the fragile walls of reality. Its healing energy is wondrous, and the corruption beyond the veil is helpless before it, driven back beyond the barriers that keep it from invading the realms of sanity and order. The light envelops Subiaco, and he lets it. And his eyes open to find his wife standing above him, her face lined with fear. He sits up and winces as a spasm of pain shoots up his spine. The cot bed is uncomfortable, but is a great deal softer than a bedroll on the ground. He sees his daughter curled in the corner of their assigned room, her blanket pulled up around her knees. She looks at him with wide, frightened eyes.
"I was having a nightmare," he says, letting out a shuddering breath.
"Everyone's having nightmares," says his wife, slipping her arms around him and resting her head on his shoulder.
"I'm not surprised," he says, looking at the walls of their quarters as though they might disintegrate at any moment and reveal the horror behind them.
He listens and thinks he can hear the faint tap, tap, tap of polished steel claws.
"What was it about?" asks his wife. "Your nightmare."
"I don't remember," he says.
Chapter 16. The Ultramarines move out in force. 1,500 warriors leave Arcology X in a kilometre-long column of heavy armour. The armoured gates open onto the blue-lit wastelands, and Legion strength, enough to subdue a world, rides out to war. Ventanus leads them, shuttered within the commander's compartment of a shadow sword. The Super Heavy's interior is not designed for post-humans, but he has found a way to press his bulk into a space designed for a mortal body. The interior of the Super Heavy smells of grease, engine oil, sweat, and sickly sweet gusts of pine-scented incense. He hears the crew chatter over the vox, but tunes it out. He does not need to hear their operational back and forth. Not yet. Though he holds no belief in the machine god of Mars, Ventanus gives a curt nod to the skull-stamped cog symbol on the bulkhead beside him. Though it goes against his grain, he touches the image with his fingertips. Not for luck, but to honour the Mechanicum forces that helped bring Kalth back from the brink. Hest, Ceramica, Uldort, and the thousands of others whose names he will never know. As if in acknowledgement of his gesture of respect, the slates around him chime with inloading data. Reels of waxy paper spit from chattering ticker tapes. Torrens feed from the cogitators of Arcology X. Geosat imagery fills the slate before him, a haze of information 4 hours old that bathes his cut-glass features in a ghostly ochre light. Their attack will reach the outer edges of Fodral Fell's foundry strongpoint in around another 5 hours. Ventanus plans to launch his attack immediately after the geosats pass overhead and paint the most up-to-date picture of the tactical situation. Nearly 100 land speeders with enclosed crew compartments skim the ruins before them, feeding back more immediate intelligence on the ground ahead, optimal attack vectors and revisions to the proposed route. It is not the way Ventanus would want to launch such a vital assault, but he suspects that few engagements in the coming war will be fought in ideal circumstances. The landscape around Ventanus is bleached of colour by the display, but even rendered in monochrome, the horror of such planetary holocaust shocks him. He saw this devastation unleashed firsthand. He knows how terrible it was. But to see the surface of Kalth like this is a stark reminder that this is not a war zone that nature will eventually reclaim. This is all that Kalth will ever be. Landshear is a skeletal steel ruin, its acreage of efficient platforms and guild halls now a blackened, shadow-haunted wasteland. Numinous fares little better, and the spaces between them are littered with the detritus of wounded strato-carriers, flattened supply crates, ruptured barrels, and upended cargo containers. Most split apart on impact, spreading their contents over thousands of square kilometres of the surface. Rifles, uniforms, food packets, boots, Medicaid supplies, and the millions of other items required by campaigning forces at war. It is as if a dozen armies marched through and discarded everything they were carrying before vanishing. None of the scattered items can be salvaged. All are too irradiated now to be of use. The crumpled spine of the Antrodamicus groans on the plains beyond Numinous City. The starship's plated hull is buckled and holed in 1,000 places. Ventanus remembers watching it fall from the sky, a sight no sane mind could have imagined. Smoke still billows from its gutted interior, weeks after it crashed into the surface like an extinction-level meteorite. It reminds Ventanus of a great plains-dwelling leviathan brought down by rapacious predator packs. A marvel of technology that once travelled between the stars in service to the greatest vision of mankind, reduced to rusting wreckage. A mighty king of the void, brought low by treachery, and left to rot on the world that most likely saw its keel first laid down. Towers stand on the horizon like broken teeth in a rotten gum, backlit by flames from the raging fires of the refinery wells. Towering drilling rigs sway, their surfaces corroding in the stellar radiation. Ventanus sees the death of a world in all directions. Cities reduced to ashen deserts, proud hubs of industry shattered beyond reclamation, and entire habitation rings pounded to glassy ruin. Kalth was never the most beauteous planet of Ultramar, but Ventanus has seen enough of the galaxy to know it was a handsome one. It had not the wonder of Prandium, its cities were not the architectural marvels of Konor, and its oceans were not as majestic as those of Macragge. Yet few worlds can match the industry of its people. Every inhabitant of Ultramar is hard-working, but the people of Kalth are fiercely proud of their reputation as the hardest workers in the 500 worlds. Its shipyards on the surface and in orbit constructed more warships than many dedicated forge worlds, and no vessel bearing the stamp of a Kalth shipwright ever failed in combat. All of that is gone. Kalth's people endure, but the world they fight for no longer exists. Ventanus remembers the Kalth that was. The dead world around him is the Kalth that is. Chapter 17. Ventanus splits his ultramarines into four spearheads, the faster vehicles moving on the flanks, while the superheavies and dreadnoughts advance up the centre. Ventanus commands this element. Celaton commands the left, Sidon's the right. Urath of the 39th will rendezvous with them at the Malonic transit, and the strike force will swell as more of their scattered brothers bleed in from each of the Landshir arterials. The Burning Cloud, the titan that killed the traitor engine Mortis Maxor, marches over the buckled superhighway of the Tarxis Traverse, its warhorn echoing mournfully over the ruins. Captain Athon's warriors are sweeping down from the north, but his force will only join with Ventanus when they meet in the middle of Fodral Fell's ruined fortress. The last element of the assault force is Icos Lamiad. Tetrarch of Ultramar, Primarch's champion, Icos of the Arm, they call him now. His army is an eclectic muster of forces stitched together from the survivors of the parched deserts and burning muster fields around the Holophusicon. Army, Skitari, and Defence Auxilia rally to his banner, together with a great Telemachus, the Sky Warrior, the twice-birthed. With his arm lost to Word-Bearer's bolts, Lamiad's warriors have declared themselves his shield-bearers. Already the survivors of the attack are building a mythology. Perhaps there is something to Sidance's assertion that they will all have names of legend by the time this war is done. Something to inter in the Museum of the Future. Ventanus drags his thoughts from potential futures to the present. He has brought together a force greater than any assembled since the muster. This is an appropriate response. What little information Torin was able to collate from the brief link with the Word-Bearer's cogitators before the betrayal indicates that Fodral Fell is a war leader of great prowess and charisma. If he is allowed to effectively rally the Word-Bearers, the war for Kalth will take decades. That cannot be allowed to happen. His fortress stronghold in the Foundry districts must be razed to the ground. The going is slower than Ventanus would like, but his timetable has allowed for this. A number of paths, thought clear from orbital picked capture, are proving to be impassable on the ground. The land speeders are creating passage with their guns or feeding back updated routes. In 5 hours, the coordinated arms of the Ultramarines' assault will be at the outskirts of Fodral Fell's stronghold, within minutes of the fresh telemetry from orbit. And armed with the most up-to-date information at his disposal, Ventanus will wipe Fodral Fell from the face of Kalth. Chapter 18. Hol Beloth follows Malok Kartho into the ruins of a Landshir starscraper whose spine has been broken. The towering structure lost its upper 300 stories when the portside void array of the Antrodamicus sheared them away with the precision of a 1,000-meter blade. The shock of that impact buckled the ventral pier and robbed the building of its structural integrity. The starscraper creaks and groans in the howling winds, and wide cracks have spread from the floor to the meters-thick support columns. It's only a matter of time until the tower collapses. Neither this nor their proximity to a known ultramarine stronghold seems to bother Malok Kartho, who leads their small warband into the corpse-choked atrium. Concussive force from an engine engagement 3 kilometres away on the Nyansa lateral blew out the building's heliotropic windows, and the scorched bodies are shrouded in ash-stained glass with brittle reflections. Eriesh Kigal and his Terminators have said little since they took possession of the weapon from the disintegrating cult warriors. Zuganara is even more uncommunicative, and Hol Beloth is beginning to feel like less of a commander and more of a passenger. "Why are we here?" he asks, stopping in the midst of the corpses. A flaking skull, black and pitted, stares up at him, the jaw sagging open with the vibration of his footfall. He crushes it beneath his boot.
"You ask a question that has vexed the greatest mind since man first learned to walk upright,"
replies Cartho. He puts a hand out to support himself, as though weary from their trek across the shattered hinterlands of Kalth. Their armor is straining to keep the worst of the radiation at bay, and the power capacitors in their backpacks will need to be recharged soon. Yet what they have endured is nowhere near enough to tire the Dark Apostle. Only now does Hol Belloth realize that Cartho no longer has his octet staff.
"You know what I mean," says Hol Belloth. "Here, this building. Why?"
Cartho cranes his neck upwards, looking through the great void at the building's heart. Hol Belloth follows his gaze. Dust and particles of glass spin in light filtered through the broken windows. They form strange patterns, spirals, loops, and hints of suggested forms just out of reach. For the briefest moment, Hol Belloth sees something in the dancing motes, but it slips from perception even as he thinks he sees it.
"We are here to witness something," says Cartho,
as though that explains everything.
"Witness what?"
demands Hol Belloth, his hand curling around the leather-wrapped grip of his sword. He no longer cares if the muttering shadows attack him. He simply wants answers.
"A moment in history,"
says Cartho, holding up his hand to forestall another angry outburst at his cryptic answer.
"Contrary to what some believe, the universe is not a sterile place. It is a grand melodrama, a tapestry of consequences, both man-made and celestial. Most are minor things, easily missed, but some are of galactic significance, universal even. And these dramas must be witnessed if they are to register in the universal paean to the Dark Monarchs. A number of such dramas are close, and we are here to bear witness to one."
"What's going to happen?" asks Hol Belloth. Cartho sighs and says,
"Climb with me, and we will witness it together."
Hol Belloth looks back up the atrium. Even with its top sliced away, the starscraper still soars to a height of nearly a kilometre and a half.
"I suppose it's too much to hope that the transit lifts still have power," says Hol Belloth.
Cartho laughs, a mockery of the sound.
"Good drama is earned," he says, setting off towards a dust and corpse-choked stairwell. "And trust me, you won't want to miss this."
Chapter 19. Like everything to do with the war on Kalth, Fodral Fell's stronghold is a thing of ugliness. Dismantled manufactoria have provided the raw materials for his fortifications. Sharp-edged bastions, low-lying artillery deflectors, and sunken blockhouses. It is a cancerous blight on the landscape, a fog-wreathed, orange-lit vision of damnation. Tar-black smoke streams up like claw marks on a canvas, and the air stinks of petrochemical fires. Ventanus remembers a word-bearer who called himself Morpal Zeer, who claimed that Fodral Fell's war host numbered in the tens of thousands. Those numbers would have been decimated by Tauren's orbital strikes, but by how much is the real question.
"Come on,"
he mutters, watching the counter on the main slate diminish. At last, it reaches zero, and heart-stopping seconds pass before the combat logister flickers to life. Real-time data inloads from the geosats. Information pours in. Ventanus processes it instantaneously, parsing tactical feeds on avenues of approach, heat signatures, topographical layouts, and enemy troop dispersals. He had feared that the word-bearers might have their own scouts in place and be ready for them, but it now appears that he was wrong to credit the enemy with such foresight. Readiness icons flash on the logister as the information passes down to his force commanders. They have seen what he has seen. They are hungry for this fight. Dogs of war straining to be let slip. Even Lamiad defers to his command. It is Ventanus's right and honour to give the word. His theoretical is solid. The practical is in place. They all know it.
"All commands
unleash havoc, orders Ventanus.